Hey, hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
And I'm Jess DeBeer, Associate Director and Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passion. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, today we are chatting with Dr. David Shanker of Stanford University. He is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and his views are his own.
Buckle up, listeners. We got an old friend of mine who's a surfer. He's a hockey guy. He's a mathematician. And he's taking his big brain to fix healthcare. Come and meet and see who's stopping by. I got a question for you.
Do you think you're
a sapiosexual?
Do I think I'm sapiosexual?
Yes.
Right off the cuff.
Well, so your husband, you know, he's a pretty smart dude, right? He's got an undergrad.
Yes. He has two undergrads and one grad.
So do you think you're attracted to him for his mind?
Yes. That is part of it. Yes. That's what that means. Sapiosexual, when you're attracted to someone for their smarts?
Yeah.
I mean, let's say this. If he had that pedigree and was not 6'9" and delicious, it would be different.
Right.
But if he was 6'9" and couldn't put a sentence together, no, definitely no.
Yeah. Listen, I am a sapiosexual. I think smart people are funnier. I think their jokes are funnier.
Duh. Yeah.
Let's get going.
Okay.
Welcome back to the show. I am especially excited for today's guest because we go way back. All the way to our undergrad days at the University of Pennsylvania. While I was earning my Bachelor of Arts, our guest was busy earning both an undergrad and a master's degree simultaneously. He is now a leading expert at the intersection of mathematics and medicine, Dr. David Shanker, PhD. Dr. Shanker is the Executive Director of Systems Design and Collaborative Research at the Stanford Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. He's also the founder and director of SERP, Standard Medicine, a group dedicated to using advanced math and operations research to dramatically improve the quality and efficiency of clinical care. From optimizing surgical scheduling and patient flow to pioneering algorithm-enabled telemedicine for chronic conditions, Dr. Shanker and his teams are applying the precision of mathematics to solve the most complex real-world problems in healthcare. Today, we're going to dive into how mathematical models can transform a hospital, why a deep-seated inefficiency can often be an opportunity, and what the future of high-tech, high-value healthcare looks like. Please welcome my friend of 25 years, Dr. David Shanker.
Snaps.
That's actually good, right?
Thank you for that generous introduction.
But I want to start with where you started, because I just love that, you know, sort of your origin story. So you and your brother were born in, I want to say Russia, but it's not. It's the Soviet Union is the technical.
Yeah, it was in Moscow in what was then the Soviet Union.
All right, so tell us about that. How do you leave there? Do you remember this at all? How old were you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I left when I was 7, so I remember. I mean, I remember like the rock soup and the belt soup, all sorts of.
And you speak Russian?
Duh.
Oh.
No, I mean, it was obviously like a horrible, repressive regime. And my parents, you know, did things like smuggle books that were illegal and try to go to court when their friends or relatives were just arrested for political reasons. My parents were already both working molecular biologists, and our family of four lived in a 3-bedroom apartment. And so the four of us lived in one bedroom. There was like a crazy hoarder lady in another bedroom, and there was a family of three in the other bedroom. And we all shared one bathroom and one kitchen.
So wait, 7 people in 3 bedrooms?
8, but 8. I'm the mathematician, so you get a pass on that one.
So I shouldn't complain. I had 2 sisters and 1 bathroom. Okay, got it. Just so I know. Wow. How do you get out?
So in the late 80s, there was so much pressure on the Soviet Union to let Jews out that my parents got out as part of that program, and they got an invitation to come to the United States from a fellow scientist friend who had already lived. But yeah, it was a trip. My parents like really had to do some things to get us out of there. You know, they didn't speak any English. They weren't allowed to take any money out of the Soviet Union. So it was definitely a tough trip on them. But again, to their credit, like fantastic experience for my brother and me.
Holy cow. All right. So they came over here. They made it work.
They made it
Golly.
Work.
Golly. Your parents get settled. You get settled. You go to an Ivy League school, right? Like I'm sure it was like a dream. Like you got to go to this school and this is a big deal. You study math. And one of the things I always thought was really interesting is like I asked you one time, like when you left with a mathematics degree and a master's, great school, Wall Street was probably calling, right? And I felt like one of the things I asked you was like, hey, why wouldn't you just do that, man? Go out there and try to do that. And you said a comment one time, you're like, I want to push the limits of what we know with mathematics that much further than all we have. Is there more to that story? Or is that really what were you just ready to do that stuff?
I actually had like headhunters finding me and trying to connect me to hedge funds and an internship at Goldman Sachs back in the day. Certainly if I'd taken that, I'd make a lot more money than I did as a mathematician. No, but it was true. I had this really idealistic, I don't see in a lot of ways naive idea that I want to like push the boundaries of knowledge. It's exciting to like genuinely explore the unknown.
So let's talk about your work. It's focused on making an immediate, tangible impact. So tell us, how does the rigorous abstract thinking from theoretical math translate into solving real-world messy problems in a hospital setting? Tell us.
There are a couple of skills. I mean, one thing is the fundamentals of theoretical math are also the fundamentals of applied math, probability theory, statistics, all of the things that you use to understand and deploy machine learning, artificial intelligence, optimization, stuff like that effectively. So you already kind of just get a baseline for the technical background that makes it easier to learn that stuff and do it well. Another part is when you're working in a system that's so complex, like a hospital or even a single hospital unit, there's so many different things that have to happen with a patient. There's so many sources of uncertainty and risk and variability. And there's so many practices that are embedded in how the doctors and nurses provide their care every day, some of which are by clinical necessity, some of which are based on personal judgment and experience, and others that are just like artifacts of tradition or how it's been done,
sure,
but not fundamentally necessary. And so picking apart a system like that to understand which parts of it you can represent as a mathematical model and which parts of it you can study with that model to try to find ways to do it better, it requires a good nose for unstated assumptions.
Okay.
Explain that.
Yeah, explain that.
I'll give you a very concrete example. One of the first things we did at the Stanford Children's Hospital was try to help move our patients through the operating rooms more quickly, because we were having problems with the post-anesthesia care unit where kids have to go after surgery filling up. Kids also have to go there after an MRI or a CT because little ones need full anesthesia to stay still in those machines. Mm-hmm. And if it gets full, then the kids can't leave the operating room.
Okay.
Now, when kids can't leave the operating room, they wake up because you can't give kids additional anesthesia just to keep them like asleep and docile. It's not good for them.
No.
I would like to keep them sedated a lot of times.
Yeah. No. Definitely not. So they wake up. They're not in pain because their pain is managed, but they're terrified. Sure. And they're just screaming. And then there's like screaming coming from the operating rooms. The next procedure can't start. You know, it's incredibly disruptive to the families, to the institution, people providing care.
Yeah.
And people kind of explain what they believe are the causes of the delays. So people scheduled the procedure inaccurately, or somebody was stuck in the PACU because they couldn't get a bed in the hospital or something else. And it's hard to separate which of the reasons that people give for the problem are just something that they remember because it happened, you know, yesterday or last week and really kind of frustrated or had a strong emotional impact, and which are the ones that are systematically driving this, you know, 8 out of 10 times every day. So, and I'm not a clinical expert, I'm not a physician. So I have to kind of listen to what people are telling me, look at the data that describes it and figure out, okay, are things as simple as people are describing, are the problems the ones they're identifying, or are there other problems that aren't being identified because they're just kind of part of the way things have always been done? So in this particular case, we saw that you could sometimes go to the PACU and there would be a nurse available standing by an empty bed, but the PACU was full and nobody could leave an operating room.
How is that?
How is that? So it turns out that before somebody comes out of the operating room, they have to reserve a PACU bed. And they're supposed to reserve the PACU bed about 20 minutes before they get there. The nurse has a chance to prepare for the patient, and it's a smooth handoff. But people have incentives. No surgeon wants her patient to be the one stuck in the room screaming, to be her next case to be delayed. So she's got those incentives to be really optimistic about how soon the patient will be ready. And when we looked into the data, we saw that over 50% of cases were calling out to reserve a bed more than 20 minutes in advance.
Okay.
And so you had delays unrelated to bed availability because you had these premature reservations. And with a lot of leadership from both Rebecca Clory, the medical director, and our other leaders in perioperative services, we moved to a just-in-time system where when the surgeon officially handed the patient over to the anesthesiologist to wake them up after surgery, that's when the reservation would go out. And we cut by more than half these reservations that happened more than 20 minutes in advance. And it really helped prevent and reduce these delays in a way that didn't require, you know, hiring anybody else, building any more beds.
Right.
So this is one kind of specific example of, there was an unstated assumption in how the whole process was running that when you realized it was there and then examined it with the data, you could really identify it as an opportunity to do better.
All right. So we kind of glossed over this, and I mentioned this in your intro. It's called SURF, Stanford Medicine. System Utilization Research for Stanford. That was your acronym, right?
That's right.
Because you're a big surfer guy, okay? So you got into this world though, right? Is in with Harvard, right? With Mass General. Tell us just briefly how you, the program that you were in at Mass General, and then what's different or the same with the program at Stanford.
I got invited to apply for this joint position between MIT and Harvard Medical School, Mass General. And I applied, they brought me out for a full day of interviews. And it was so exciting and so dynamic to interact with both the engineers on MIT side, walk across the bridge and interact with the doctors, nurses, administrators, that based on that one day experience, I decided to change careers. And I told them that if they offered me the job, I would take it.
So then this program at Stanford that you're now championing and you're in charge, did you build this thing? Did you get recruited over there? Like, hey, Dr. Shanker, do what you did at Mass General?
Yeah.
Dr. Shanker, let's talk about hospital operations. So you've tackled complex problems like optimizing surgical scheduling, patient flow. Tell us, what is one of the most surprising inefficiencies you've uncovered, and how did a mathematical approach lead to a practical solution?
One of the things is in type 1 diabetes care, that's where we've done a lot of our work. You know, these kids are diagnosed when they're very young, and it's just this full-time job for them and their family. And the care team has to try to help them manage the diabetes. And the technology has advanced so much. It used to be the only way to measure your blood glucose would be to poke your finger a few times a day and drop that blood in the little sensor. And now there are continuous glucose monitors that you can wear, and they take measurements every 5 minutes. There are insulin pumps that you can wear and that instead of having to give injections. Mm-hmm. But the practice of managing diabetes was nowhere near harnessing the power of these technologies. When we first started this, David Maz, he's the division chief of pediatric endocrinology, came and said, you know, help us figure out if we can help our clinic work more efficiently. And the practice back then was still to print out the last 14 days of someone's continuous glucose monitor data and just look at this trace for 14 days briefly before you met with the patient in person.
Okay.
And so David and Priya Prahalad and others started this amazing program to try to get the patients to start using a continuous glucose monitor and an insulin pump as soon as possible after diagnosis. And my team helped build technology so that when the kid is doing great, wonderful, don't bother them. When the kid isn't doing great and there's an opportunity to help them improve, say, change their pre-dinner insulin a little bit, then the care team shouldn't have to be reading out through 14 pages of printouts and waiting to see that when the person comes. Algorithms should do that. And algorithms should tell the care team, hey, these are the patients that are doing great. These are the patients that are having some trouble. And when you click on the patients that are having trouble, it shows you exactly the data about where the trouble is, and the care provider experts looking at those data, that's enough for them to know, okay, I can send the patient a message giving a recommendation.
Love that. All right, so I want to move on because we got a lot to cover with you. Socioeconomic factors, let's talk about that. You study these factors that shape healthcare cost and quality. So in your view, what's the single biggest opportunity for hospitals to improve quality while reducing costs on a systemic level?
So there's this thing called quality-associated waste. Basically, it's a way to improve your care by reducing wasteful spending. And pretty much everything we do, typically, it's with the intent of either quality or cost, but inevitably it hits both. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you prevent kids from getting infections while they're in the hospital by targeting infection prevention efforts better. You improve quality and you save the hospital a lot of money. I think the biggest opportunity is nursing. Nurses provide far more patient care than anybody else in the hospital. You know, you have one doctor or one doctor in residence, they round on a unit once or twice a day, but the nurses are the ones that are with the patients every single minute and hour of the day. Yep. Nurse-led care is this, you know, movement in healthcare. So it's also one of the highest expenses in healthcare. Almost universally, the nurse manager of a unit is in charge of the nurse staffing for that unit, which is great because they have the expertise to know which nurses have which specialties that patients need.
Okay.
When the unit needs more nurses or fewer nurses based on the number of patients or how sick they are.
Yeah.
But they rarely have optimization tools. They rarely have.
It's just gut instinct. It's like, my wife talked about this. Somebody's just been hanging around for a long time. You do that. Huh. I'm with you.
They rarely have like the quantitative support to help optimize their nurse workload in concert with everything else that's going on at the hospital. I think that's the biggest opportunity, because if you don't send nurses home because you had fewer patients than you expect, if you don't force nurses to stay 14 hours longer than they wanted to, you can improve their quality of life. You can reduce burnout, which is a huge issue for every hospital.
Yeah.
And that will translate into better, happier, healthier nurses and patients. And that's probably the biggest cost-saving opportunity.
So we've heard you talk about the high cost of administrative waste in the U.S. healthcare system. So tell us, what are the most significant drivers of this administrative burden? And what are the most promising avenues for using systems designed to cut those costs?
When you answer this, just so we're clear, I want you to talk about Wall Street model infiltrating your healthcare model.
Yeah, absolutely. Swaps, financial instruments, used to cost $100,000 in lawyers' fees to like create and write one. Mm-hmm. And then people are like, this is a lot. Why don't we create the unified code of swaps, standardize things, and now it can cost $5,000 when you want to create a new financial instrument. And, you know, finance, that's one of the few industries that moves more money than healthcare. There are 320,000 health plans between hospitals and health insurance companies, or care providers and health insurance companies in this country. It's like one for every 1,000 people. And every single one of them is just this 100 or 200 page PDF that's just words.
Yeah.
So there's no standardization or systemization of this contracting. And you hear a lot of horror stories about people dying or having horrible outcomes because their prior authorization took too long or sure. because care was denied, or doctors and nurses spending more time fighting with insurance companies than with patients.
Yeah.
So those are, I think, are all symptoms of this underlying root cause, this complexity. I think the biggest opportunity is to move towards a system where the contracts between health insurers, and that includes the government as well, and healthcare providers are standardized in a way that you can make them digital instead of making them multi-hundred page long PDFs. Once you have that foundation of standardization, far more things can become digital, far more things can become automated, and then you're freeing up time for the doctors and nurses, and then you're reducing delays for the patients.
Let's talk about your global perspectives. I think that's pretty cool. You and your brother are born in Russia. Your wife's Italian from Italy, not just, you know, South Jersey Italian. Your brother's wife is from Nepal, right? Legit, right? Okay. So you've got like this profound international family. So number one, are you like drawn to that? And how do you think this kind of shapes some of your perspective in the world?
I think pragmatically, a lot of Americans are too pragmatic to pursue science. When you go into academia and into research fields, you see a lot more people from other countries. I think a lot of I think a lot of people born in the US that have the skills that you would need to make it in academia, just apply those skills in other places where they make more money.
So let's talk about aspiring students. Talk about the aspiring students and researchers that are interested in combining a math, engineering, and medical career. What is the single most important piece of advice you could give for those folks?
Go to a hospital, a nursing home, an outpatient clinic or surgical center, and find a way to work with them. Find a way to volunteer there. Find a way to look at what they're doing and get exposed to the real world problems. There's so much opportunity everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to go places, see what you like, see what, you know, challenges you. I think probably more important than the place is the person. You need someone in a healthcare institution that's willing to take a chance on a non-healthcare background, engineer, math person.
Okay.
And to bring them in.
Yeah.
And more in healthcare, that's common. And so what I'd say is find an advocate, find someone that's really excited about the potential to use math and engineering, as opposed to someone that's, you know, skeptical and like willing to maybe consider it.
Talk about projects that are coming up within SURF Stanford Medicine. Anything you're particularly excited about? What's getting the juices flowing?
Yeah. The diabetes work is ongoing, and we're always kind of pushing how much can technology help our care providers, save them time, and give them more opportunity to help the patients. Mm-hmm. Talked about that a little bit. Another is this contract standardization. I've got this great collaborator, Kevin Schulman, and we're doing a lot of work and kind of publishing both theoretical and viewpoint papers advocating this as a $1 trillion opportunity for the country. The last one is, for hospital operations, I think large language models like ChatGPT and Claude, mm-hmm. really exciting. There's a lot of news and academic work about them replacing doctors, and I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
But one of the challenges in healthcare is that, you know, hospitals use incredibly sophisticated medical technology, the imaging, the robotics, the precision medicine. Mm-hmm. But a lot of their operational technology is not particularly modern, like whiteboards, fax machines, magnet boards to arrange surgical procedures.
Yeah.
That's in a lot of places state of the art. Part of the problem is the electronic medical records like Epic, they're incredibly closed. There's nothing like an app store. Epic made one attempt at that and then didn't take it seriously. So there's no way for people to develop technology that easily integrates with electronic medical records to help care providers, you know, run things better. So that means technology adoption is more difficult. One of the things I think is really exciting is large language models serving as an interface between technology and people. so that the people in the hospital don't have to learn how to use a new tool. I think having them serve as an interface with powerful deterministic tools that do exactly what you want them to.
Yeah.
Not, you know, just kind of hallucinate things. I think that that's really exciting. We're doing some work in that space.
Your initial career shift was for immediate impact, right? You started your career as a research mathematician. You switched to healthcare operations to work on an interdisciplinary team and have more immediate impact. And now that you've been leading SURF for years, what has been the single most rewarding project that showed you, yes, this is that immediate impact I was looking for?
I mean, I think there's diabetes work. We used to have something like 24% of our patients meeting the targets for what's considered good diabetes management a year after diagnosis. We serve a population that's about a third Hispanic, almost 40% publicly insured. And typically, these populations just get a lot less benefit from technology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the last time we reported on this, 67% of the kids in this clinic a year after diagnosis are meeting the ADA targets. But, you know, to contribute something to that where you see these kids are doing so much better. And in fact, we recently published a study showing 3 years after diagnosis, most of the kids that stay in the program maintain that high level of really good management. You know, and this is the kind of thing that drastically reduces your risk of going blind, losing limbs to amputation, and these other like horrible long-term outcomes associated with diabetes.
I wish I could have returns like that for clients. 27, that's right? Damn good. All right, so our signature question. So people, we ask everybody that we interview here, what is your earliest memory surrounding money and what does money mean to you?
Probably when we were in New York and we went to some Toys R Us or something and my parents like, you can have $50 of toy spending on whatever you want. It was my birthday.
Okay.
And that was, to me, like unfathomable riches. Literally, I had, my brother and I each had like a single little car that would change color when you poured water on it that we kept for years as a like prized toy. I mean, not a lot of consumer goods or a ton of toys in the Soviet Union, nor space for them when you're moving across the world. So probably that one.
You probably went to FAO Schwartz and dropped $50 on the car. You probably pocketed
some of that. It was definitely Toys R Us. We were definitely trying to stretch that 50.
So what does money mean to you?
Freedom to do the things you want to do.
Listen, let me tell you, thank you so much. This is really important. I know you get asked to speak all over. You're doing us a favor. So we appreciate you doing this. And thanks for stopping by.
This was really great. Thank you for having me, Jessica. Really nice to meet you.
So great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Great to see you.
Can't wait till we drop this with our other buddies from college. And they're like, what the hell? Why didn't you have me on? Like, oh, sorry. You're not that interesting.
That's right.
You're not changing the world like Dr. Shanker. All right. Going back to your life. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Hey, buddy. You are a saposexual. I can tell. You're getting intrigued by Dr. Shanker.
I surround myself by brilliant people. Okay? You should be flattered. All right?
Hey, you let me slip in there. I appreciate that.
I'm just saying. Just saying.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.